and welcome to Saver, production of iHeartRadio. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we have an episode for you about mooses.
Yes. Which had a very funny miscommunication on our part, because you said, I would like to do an episode on moose. And I was like, okay. And I was envisioning the animal. A moose. And I was just unfamiliar with the food culture around a moose. But it turns out you did not mean that at all.
Yeah. I clarified fairly quickly because I think I saw your moose gears processing. And I was like, no, like mooses, like the foam. And then you went,
I just like that's the first place my mind went was, it is one of my first memories is seeing a moose.
Really?
Truly eating some cereal. And I was like, oh, that's my cereal, you moose. So maybe that's why.
Okay.
Yeah. I think we should just leave it at that. Let's not explain that any further.
I think it's self-explanatory. I think that the fact that a moose was stealing your breakfast cereal early in your life and that this is one of your earliest life memories, I think that that actually explains quite a bit about you as it stands.
I love cereal, too. You know I love cereal.
Yeah.
And that moose was coming in, eating my cereal.
Dang.
No. No.
Rude. Impolite.
Very, very impolite. But he just kind of wandered away eventually, so it's all good.
Good, because those things are very large.
They're huge. I like, honestly, that is one of the things I remember most about that very early memory is it was huge.
Yeah.
It was huge. All right, but it's not, we're not talking about that.
Okay, no.
Yes. Did you have any particular reason this was on your mind?
We're kind of coming up on Father's Day here, and I was sort of thinking like, oh man, like what's, like my dad was a chef, which meant that he didn't really cook at home. But one of the like special occasion things that he would make was chocolate mousse. And he had a recipe that was, I think, like garnered from maybe a combination of like Julia Child and the Silver Palette and his own personal experience. He had this recipe that I have very fond memories of. And so and it was a little bit like it was nicer on the research than some of the other stuff that came to mind. So
yeah, that's interesting that you say that, because my dad also loved chocolate mousse, and he also loved, I've mentioned it before, but he loved those kind of real old school cafeteria type restaurants.
Yeah. Like sort of like, it's not quite a buffet, but it's like,
right.
Yeah. Cafeteria it's style.
Like, yeah. You'd get a tray and then there'd be the vegetable section and the meat section or protein section and then the dessert section. And he loved those. And there was one, I feel like I'm really harping on this point, but I grew up in a small town, everybody. It was like a 30-minute drive away, so it was sort of a special occasion. And we would go, and I would always get the chocolate mousse for dessert, and it was delicious.
Yeah. I do love a chocolate mousse.
It was really good. I know I've mentioned before, though, the tray situation. I would shake so badly that the stress of the whole thing was almost not worth it.
Oh, but
The chocolate mousse is very good, but I would just be like,
oh no.
It was too much. Too much.
All right. Well, you survived it. You've pulled through. Yeah.
I did. And there used to be one near, I went to school at Georgia Tech, and there used to be one near there. And every now and then I would convince my old roommate to go. And it was never quite great, but the memories, the nostalgia was so strong.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, we had a holiday party this past year, and there was chocolate mousse for dessert.
Oh, there was. You're right. And then I was thinking, I have seen a lot of mousses / foams on menus lately, as in before the pandemic.
Sure.
I can't remember. What's the name for that? Modern
Like
gastronomy.
Like gastronomy stuff? Molecular gastronomy?
Yes. There we go.
Yeah.
A lot of that has juices and foams in there. So it's a bit of a thing.
And a kind of a return to savory mousses as well.
Yes. Which we are going to talk about some.
National Mousse Day is a thing that we have here in the United States. It's November 30th every year. We also have a specifically National Chocolate Mousse Day. That is April 3rd. So we are nowhere near either of those.
Perfect. I love it. I feel like that's very on brand.
Yeah.
So I'm happy.
Yeah.
I'm already excited about the pun opportunities here.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Uh-huh. You can see our Downton Abbey episode for more on fish mousse specifically, and our chocolate episode for more about chocolate, perhaps obviously, and our white chocolate episode, I would say.
Yeah. Also, our French cuisine history episode from pretty early on. Maybe aspics. Maybe whipped cream.
Yeah.
Maybe molecular gastronomy. Yeah.
Agreed. I think that I couldn't remember the name, and I tried to search it, but I didn't have the right.
You didn't have the right
terms to search it.
Yeah.
But you came through as you always do. All right. So I think this brings us to our question. Mousse. What is it?
a mousse is a type of dish that's made up of a foam. That is, air bubbles stabilized in a liquid or solid. And mousse describes specifically a, like, creamy, firm liquid or soft, solid texture. A mousse can be sweet or savory, light or dense, chilled or frozen or warm, stabilized in any number of ways. What you're looking for is that creamy, airy, melt-in-your-mouth texture. It's like if a cloud were more solid, or if leavened bread were more liquid. Somewhere in between there.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I see it.
Yeah. Yeah. If a crunch bar were pudding. Yeah, I don't know. Some popular and or traditional types of mousse include chocolate mousse or apricot mousse on the dessert side, or yes, seafood mousse or chicken liver mousse on the savory side, but really anything that you can either puree or melt to a smooth texture can be made into a mousse. And the key here is creating and then stabilizing your air bubbles. And you can do that in just a lot of ways. Let's take what most of us are probably the most familiar with these days, which is chocolate mousse, as our example. Okay, so because chocolate contains fats that are solid at room temperature, you can technically make a chocolate mousse just from solid chocolate and water. Like 4 parts solid chocolate to 3 parts water, all right? You melt the chocolate into the water to create a smooth sauce, then whisk or beat that sauce in a bowl over ice to create air bubbles as it thickens back into a soft solid, thickens and solidifies into that soft solid. You can then chill it to set it even more. The solid fats in the chocolate hold the structure. The chocolate isn't super good at forming up around air bubbles, though, so it will be like a fairly dense mousse. It's not going to be too airy. But if you whip cream or eggs or both and fold those into a chocolate sauce, which many recipes call for, it's not really assisting in stabilizing the bubbles, but it helps a lot in creating the bubbles, okay? Because both of those things contain, as we've spoken about before in some of those other episodes we mentioned, they contain globules of fat and proteins that will unravel and then form up in a matrix around air bubbles when you whisk them. So they're a really good vehicle for getting airiness into the chocolate. And they're also creamy, so they add a nice layer of that to the texture. And then if you do want to make it more stable, you can add other stabilizing agents than just the chocolate. Gelatin is a popular one because it's flavorless and it's a super stable protein network when it's chilled below room temperature. Butter is also a fairly common one because, like the cocoa butter fats, it will be solid-ish at room temperature and slightly chilled. But you can use any kind of stabilizing agent. I've seen recipes for mousse made with a silken tofu or with aquafaba. There are also commercial or industrial stabilization agents on the market for like making and setting mousses and other foams if you need to make, I don't know, 1,000 servings or something like that.
Oof, 1,000 servings. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, like that's like chocolate is that example. But again, like with like once you understand that a mousse is just trapped air bubbles in something, if you understand that you can whip certain stuff to get air bubbles in there and that you can stabilize that whip with other stuff, you can make any kind of mousse you want. You can make it with fruits or vegetables or squash or cheeses or proteins. You can flavor them with anything you want, really, like anything from maple syrup to hot pepper. They can be served alone or layered with sweet or savory pastry or ice creams or whatever you want.
I want to experience this world of mousse, especially cheese mousse.
Oh, yeah.
I'm intrigued by that.
Yeah, especially like a soft, like something soft, like a ricotta.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, well, all right. What about the nutrition?
Generally speaking, a mousse is going to be a nutrient-dense food because of all of the fats that are required to trap and stabilize those air bubbles. But it depends. It depends on your ingredients. I guess watch your portion sizes. Treats are nice.
Treats are nice.
Yeah.
We're a big proponent of treats over here.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a single number for you.
We do have one number. Okay, so there is a Guinness World Record for the largest chocolate mousse by weight ever created. The record is from 2013. And that is when this mall in Aventura, Florida, the Aventura Mall, mixed up this chocolate mousse that weighed 497 pounds. That's 225 kilos. It's a lot of mousse. It included 108 pounds of chocolate, 66 pounds of butter, 24 pounds of egg yolk. They were measuring them by the pound at that juncture. I love it. 20 pounds of sugar, 50 quarts of heavy cream, and 5 gallons of milk.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's... And the more of those numbers that I read, the more upsetting it was. Like, chocolate mousse is an incredibly delightful dish, but I hoofed a.
Indeed.
Yeah.
I have to say, too, every now and then we do a topic where I'm surprised at the local articles that keep popping up.
Yeah.
A lot of this, for chocolate mousse specifically, were from Florida. And I was like, huh, interesting.
I would say, and this is just me spitballing, having lived in Florida for a number of years, and in South Florida specifically, that South Florida really held on to the kind of like late 70s to mid 80s vibe of cooking and restaurateuring way longer than a lot of other places in America. Like they kind of caught on early and they just stuck with it. They were like, well, this is what we're doing now. And so I feel like a chocolate mousse is a very South Florida dish.
Yeah. That was the vibe I was getting. Okay. So I'm glad to hear you say that I wasn't just lost in the wilderness of the internet. Why are all these articles from Florida coming up?
Or, I mean, you know, I don't know. Like, it's also, like, that strange thing of, like, Google results can be – I don't know how you've got your Google results tuned and whether or not, like, it knows that sometimes you visit Florida and so it thinks that you want more results from Florida. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. A lot to think about.
There you
go.
When
it comes to the internet and chocolate mousse. But it wasn't always this way.
No. Chocolate mousse is a relatively recent invention. And we are going to get into that history after we get back from a quick break for a word from our sponsors.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so the history of mousse is hard to pin down. But we are going to give it our best shot. And this is going to be largely focused on chocolate mousse, particularly because that's what people have written about. But we're going to have some stuff about savory mousses in here too. A lot of people brought up pâté in their articles writing about this. That is a separate episode for us.
Yeah.
But just wanted to acknowledge similarities.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Totally. And it actually starts with savory mousses.
It does. But kind of, it's not necessarily stepping back, but like focusing.
Reframing.
Reframing is good. Many historians do place the birthplace of chocolate mousse specifically in France, which I think a lot of people I know, and me included, kind of think of France when we think about chocolate mousse. But the when of that is a bit of a mystery. The when in time that happened is a bit of a mystery. Chocolate itself arrived in France by the early 1600s. And at first it was mostly used in hot drinks. But this was a time of a lot of experimentation amongst French chefs. And chocolate certainly got wrapped up in all of that. All right. But yes, pivoting, by the 18th century, finely whipped savory foam-like mousses were really popular in parts of Europe. They often had a base of seafood, poultry, or liver. Similar related things like fish jellies, often eaten by those abstaining from meat on Fridays, go back to the 15th century, and that is a fun rabbit hole that I recommend.
Oh, yeah. And certainly there's crossover with our aspics episode there.
Yes.
Meanwhile, the word mousse applied to these savory, foamy dishes in the 1700s was just the French word for foam. Or like a sort of poetic description for foam. And the word mousse may trace back to an old French meaning that's more like froth or scum and includes the root word for mead, like honey wine, which makes me think that mousse might have originally been the word for like the like frothy barm that develops as mead ferments, maybe. But I've also read the theory that the word mousse descends from the same roots as the word moss, like the plant. So, mysteries, histories.
Indeed. It wasn't until the mid-1800s that we started to see dessert mousses, primarily composed of fruits at that time, pop up in the historical record. The term mousse au chocolat was first published in a French language dictionary in 1855 or 1857, roundabout there, when the first recipes for dessert mousses started appearing in American and English cookbooks. They were frequently labeled as a type of ice cream or sometimes as a parfait. And it has been a hot minute since I've thought about parfaits. I went through a huge parfait phase.
Okay. Yeah.
I had just totally forgotten about it. And now I want to do an episode on parfait.
Okay. All right. Adding it to the list. Cool.
Our very long list. Yes. a lot of these recipes were closer to how we'd think of chocolate pudding as opposed to the lighter, airier mousses of today. And I have a couple quotes I wanted to share.
Okay. Yes. Heck yeah.
You know I love a good quote. Here's one from an 1894 cookbook about mousses. Quote, "These are a go-between soufflés and ordinary iced creams. They are lighter and more spongy than the latter, on which account they are often better liked. They have the further advantage of needing no freezing before they are molded. The mixture is first thickened over the fire like a custard, then put in the mold and set in an ice cave until firm enough to turn out. A cave is a necessity for the proper concoction of these dishes. To ensure success, they need great care and preparation.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so many things that I love about that.
Yeah. Yeah. The term ice cave is one that I always forget about until I run across it. And then I'm like, man.
Yes.
That sounds so much cooler than refrigerator, no pun intended.
It does. I like the pun. I like it.
I didn't mean it. I just do them now. I'm sorry.
It's the savor curse / blessing? I don't know.
It definitely gets me a lot of flat stares from my friends.
But joy from me.
Well, there you go. Joy there you from go. Me.
Here's another quote from the Oxford Companion to Food. Mousse, a French term meaning foam, is applied to dishes with foamy texture, usually cold and often sweet, but also savory and sometimes hot. The term was in common use in France by the 18th century. Menon has recipes for frozen mousses. Chocolate mousse is well known internationally. Other mousses, such as those incorporating ham or fish or asparagus, are more likely to be found in a French context. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I love that too, where it's like, it's usually cold, but sometimes hot. It's usually sweet, but sometimes savory.
Oh, yeah. That, uh-huh.
Could be anything. Could be anything.
Oxford just covering all the bases, as they usually do.
Mm-hmm. The English were using the word mousse by the 1890s. The oldest print reference of chocolate mousse out of America that we know of was published in 1892. A couple of sources specifically credit the invention of chocolate mousse to French artist and sometimes chef Henri Toulouse-Lautrec in the 19th century. According to this version of events, the artist enjoyed experimenting in the kitchen and created something called mayonnaise de chocolat, essentially chocolate mousse. I have my doubts about this, but a lot of people mentioned it, so...
Yeah, anytime you bring up Toulouse as, like, the originator of something, I'm like, that's a nice story.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, I'm sure he ate some chocolate mousse in his time. That seems extremely likely. But yeah, and the term mayonnaise de chocolat does appear very frequently in these histories, and you know, would have certainly made sense in a historical context of people being familiar with this sauce mayonnaise, but and then applying that to like this other thing,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So here in the U.S., the rise of chocolate mousse coincided with the rise of chocolate pudding mixes around the 1930s. Part of what helped chocolate mousse along were inventions or improvements around things like electric mixers that made it so, so much easier to whip the egg whites to achieve the texture that we're more familiar with today, which also happened around this time. And then you can see our Aspic episode for more on this, but with the invention of home refrigeration and more availability of home refrigeration, perhaps, and love of gelatin molds in the 1950s, fish mousses spent several decades on American tables.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, their star faded, though they are experiencing a bit of a resurgence here. Again, look up pictures, because, like, a lot of the fish molds, they're shaped like fish.
Yeah.
They're made of, like,
yeah, and especially when you get like salmon or something, it's just this really pretty like pastel orange color. Yeah, it's a whole thing.
It is indeed a whole thing, and I recommend looking into it. The popularity of chocolate mousses grew in the U.S. alongside the growth of the popularity of French cuisine in general.
Right, which was really booming through the 60s and 70s. By 1977, it was a common enough word in English, and I guess hair care technology was advancing to the point that the word was being applied to hair products of a similar texture. And we also verbed that noun a few years later. By 1984, I believe, we were using terms like mousse your hair as a verb to apply mousse to. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then with America's love of white chocolate in the 80s, white chocolate mousse became a very popular. Mm-hmm. Most people credit this invention with New York City chef Michael Fattoussi in 1977. By all accounts, it was a hit. It was a hit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like to the point that because of the chocolate mousse's popularity, and I'm, you know, white chocolate mousse and other mousses all forming into this. Yeah. Chocolate mousses have, in fact, been studied by food scientists looking to create acceptable vehicles for medicinal products like, say, probiotics and prebiotics since at least the early 2000s. So they're like, enough people like this stuff that let's try putting stuff in them and see if we can get them to actually consume what we're trying to get them to consume that way.
Okay.
Another science note. In 2020, the ESA, the European Space Agency, teamed up with Nestle to run some experiments on the structure of foam in microgravity using equipment on the ESA's parabolic flights. You know, like the not quite space reaching vomit comet flights. Yeah. Yeah. And this team up happened because, like, foam technologies are of interest to both parties. They're of interest in terms of making palatable food products to both of them, and then to the ESA for lots of other, like, lightweight structural reasons. So, like, the more that they understand about foams, right, just the more they can do with astronaut food and structural science.
I feel like we should get some kind of bonus every time we can mention space in these episodes.
I feel like I'm getting a bonus every time I run across a fact like this. So,
well, that's nice, but I want a monetary
you,
bonus.
You want, yeah, yeah.
And it's mostly NASA. You that does it, but I'm trying to.
Oh, no, I see. No, NASA, call us. Like, yes. Let us know.
Ooh, yes.
I mean, in general, NASA, call us. Goodness. At any rate, also that year, 2020, and I didn't follow up with this. I just saw a very brief article about it. But a moose-centric dessert bar opened in New York City.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Well, I'm very curious about that. If anyone's been, please.
Yeah,
it was like
February of 2020. Oh. So I strongly suspect this poor guy had a hard time. But yeah, moose bar.
Moose bar.
I want to go to a moose bar.
I would like to as well. And immediately, I'm thinking of the animal, but I'm gonna. Switch
yeah,
my...
that sounds okay too. Yeah, either, you know.
Maybe both.
Yeah. Ooh. Ooh, okay. All right.
Business idea. Terrible one, I think, but business idea.
Yeah, yeah, maybe I don't think I'm allowed to open any bars, especially not ones that have live moose in them. So that's, I'm going to preemptively shelve that.
Okay. But it is on the shelf.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. Cool. Well, we'll revisit that at a later date. But for now, I think that's what we have to say about moose.
It is. We do have some listener mail for you. But first, we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsors.
Back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with
Listener Mail.
Ooh, light and bubbly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I try. Okay, so I love this. We have two letters addressing another listener mail.
Ooh, okay,
that
great.
We read.
Great, great.
About cast iron.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm. All right. So first, Amanda wrote, I know I totally just wrote you, but a listener, Ben, I believe, wrote in about adjusting to induction from gas in regards to cast iron. Mm-hmm. We own an appliance store, and I am terrible at understanding anything electrical, but how I understand it from training sessions is induction works differently. With gas and regular electric ranges, smoother coil top, the element gets hot, which in turn heats the pot or whatever. Induction works by using magnetics to induce a current directly into the pot or pan, turning the pot or pan into the element itself, thus making any temperature changes pretty close to instant, whether you're trying to boil water in 90 seconds, as advertised, or the going from a full rolling boiling over to a gentle simmer pretty close to instantly. As I burn hot dogs while typing this. Also, handy tip for you accident-prone humans. The stovetop itself doesn't get hot, just whatever residual heat is transferred from having a hot pot on top of it. Anyhow, all that said, as far as adjusting to the new stove, maybe picturing all of this will help if all that made sense. But in reality, you just kind of got to keep cooking and get used to it. Also, love the recent Onigiri episode. All those recipes sound way better than what I end up with, which is a handful of leftover sushi rice, usually from my sushi tacos, squished into, well, some sort of shape, strip of nori, added with a dash of furikake, and plopped onto my six-year-old's plate, as I don't know what to make you for lunch kind of meal. LOL. Thank you for brightening my day every week with your beautiful senses of humor and nerdy references. Every time you mention Brock's Jelly Donuts, it makes me very happy. Us too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Spoiler alert, induction cooking is definitely coming up as an episode topic soon. So, Yeah, that's a spoiler for Annie as well as for y'all.
I love it. Oh, this is exciting. Also, I wanted to share before we go into this next message that is similar. I made spam musubi.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you sent pictures to us and super producers Dylan and Andrew.
I did, because I was so proud. Because I have a lot of nori, as I said, and I'm trying to use it up. I haven't made the onigiri yet, but I'm planning on making it next week. But the spam musubi, I thought it was going to be really complicated, and it was kind of tricky. But it worked out really well, and it was delicious.
Yay!
And I used the spam. So I like cut the bottom off of the spam container and you use that to shape it.
It was awesome. That was so cool. Perfect. That's so good.
Yes. It was very good.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know you have like rice fear. The rice came out okay?
It did come out okay. I recently inherited an Instapot.
Oh, okay.
So I haven't used that yet, but I hear that that makes rice cooking very easy. But I just did it based on what the package said, and it turned out great.
Heck yeah.
It was so very sticky. I was.
All right.
They were right. I had to put water and vinegar on my hands so it wouldn't stick to me. It was a whole thing, but it was great. It was very good.
Now I'm craving that. I'm like, oh no. Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. We can do this. We can get this done. At any rate, Kelly wrote, I just heard your listener mail episode 12 that included the question from Ben in Ireland about using his cast iron skillet on an induction burner / hob. Please relay this message to him if you think he would find it useful. We have also recently begun using our cast iron pans on an induction burner or hob and have noticed that it takes some getting used to, as there is a difference in how they heat up. We still have our gas range, but we got a single plug-in induction unit because I wanted to try it out. Having used it consistently for a few months, I now prefer it over gas, although my husband hasn't used it as much and prefers to stick with the gas range for most things because he finds it more predictable. He agrees that the induction burner is faster and more efficient for when we boil water for pasta, etc. I'm not an expert, but I think I have an explanation for what Ben is noticing. On an induction burner, the metal of the pan itself is heating in response to the magnetic waves, whereas on a gas range, it's being heated by the flame. cast iron is a relatively poor conductor, so in both cases it takes some time before the entire pan gets hot. And it will heat up first and fastest wherever it's in contact with either the flame, in terms of gas, or the magnetic coil under the surface of the induction burner. Those coils can be different sizes, but I'm willing to bet that Ben is probably putting his skillet on a burner that has a coil with a larger surface area than the flame of his former gas burner. So a larger section of the pan is becoming hot as soon as the coil is activated.
I love this.
Yeah.
I love that you listeners are coming through for each other.
Right? Mm-hmm. This is some like Sherlock Holmes of cookery stuff going on. I love it.
Yes. And in this message, I love how it was like, pass this along.
That's so yes. good. Consider it passed.
We have done our duty and you have done yours as well. This is so great.
Yeah. Oh, goodness. Thank you.
Yes, we appreciate it so, so, so much. Thanks to both of these listeners for writing in. If you would like to write to us, you can. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
We are also on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram @SaverPod. And we do hope to hear from you. Saver is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks as always to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.